Welcome to Children of the 80s.
Hi, I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Jim.
Welcome back to the Sick Edition.
The Sick Edition. People are going to wonder what you're talking about.
I know, right? Just a little sick around here, but yeah, that's okay.
We're running a little bit behind schedule because streptococcus hit the household.
I didn't know what you were saying. Let's do not teach Emmy that word. So we are running a little bit behind schedule. We are determined we are going to live. We all have medication, so.
And hot tea and honey.
Yep. And cough drops.
Really, the only reason why I'm able to speak now is cough drops and hot tea and honey.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay, so what are we doing today? We're not going to spend the whole time talking about how sick we are.
No, I didn't know if you got any feedback from last episode.
So I did get feedback from our friend Brad over at
Pop Culture Yearbook.
Pop Culture Yearbook, yes. And, you know, he's a big Garfield fan. Mm-hmm. So, of course, he remembered the Garfield Halloween special that we talked about. But he also remembered the Garfield special that I'm assuming maybe came on in the summertime, where John and Garfield go on vacation. They don't say Hawaii, but basically it's Hawaii. And Odie stows away in the luggage, so he's there too. And all sorts of craziness ensues. And I got so excited that he remembered it, because of course I remember it, but I just thought I was like the only person out there that remembered that. And so that kind of got me thinking about maybe something else we'll do down the road. I kind of feel like Garfield deserves an episode.
Garfield definitely deserves an episode, and I have an idea for two podcast guests that might want to join.
So that's exciting. So yeah, I got some feedback about that. Got some feedback about the costumes.
Yeah, what was that?
I hate that I keep saying this because I'd love to not be this way. I'm not the best with social media. I meant to post the pictures of myself as a child that I showed you during our last episode. I meant to post it on social media, and I never did. Mm-hmm. So a couple of people messaged me asking to see the pictures. So I passed those along. And then I also got some pictures in return of those hot, hard plastic, you know, face masks that everybody wore back in the 80s. And the plastic, like, apron t-shirt thing that came in the box with the mask. And so I enjoyed seeing the costumes that kids put together back then. That was fun.
Yeah, I got some feedback from my brothers, obviously, because, you know, I talked about Halloween and our childhood, and so they really liked hearing about those memories, because it sparked memories for them and made them smile. And then the previous episode about the Halloween playlist, where I said my friend Jeff fooled me into thinking that my brother Mike also talked about that too. He's like, Jeff was always trying that stuff, and he's like, he got me on that one too.
Yeah.
So that was funny. And then I got another text from someone who 100% agreed with me on that nasty kind of caramel waxy candy that came in the orange and black wrappers. And he just basically said, yeah, that's just admitting that you're just lazy and you're going to go the cheapest way possible and feed some kids some wax.
And you also had a friend that I think gave you some feedback on the rice under chili, that was disgusting.
Which, oh, yes,
totally backs up what you think.
Yes, yes.
But your brother. But
my brother defended you.
Yes.
Which kind of shocked me, because him and I grew up in the same household. So I think he should be kicked out of the family for saying that rice goes under chili.
He said white chicken chili.
He did, so I guess that's a little bit different. But still, I know. No.
So I am going to dress up next year as Holly Hobbit. So I've got a year to figure this out.
Okay.
But I'm going to be Holly Hobbit.
You're going to be Holly Hobbit. All right.
The segment that we do on Who Died This Week, Sadly, we have Matthew Perry to add to that list.
That is correct. Matthew Perry, who starred in Friends, which you all may be hollering, that's a 90s show and you're an 80s.
I know.
But here's the deal. You and I watched an episode of Silver Spoons where Matthew Perry was in it.
Yes, that's right.
Silver Spoons ended in 1986, so Matthew Perry is part of our 1980s family.
There you go. Yeah, there is a specific evening that I think of sporadically during my time in college, and it was a Thursday night, isn't that when Friends came on?
Yes.
It's a Thursday night, and I'm at my godparents' house, and I'm sure we've been to dinner, and I'm saying, we always did like a late dinner with them, and I'm saying, okay, we have to be back to your house because it's the season finale of Friends, and I have to see that. And I remember racing back, watching the season finale of Friends with my godfather, and I think of that night, regardless of, you know, all the talk that's been going on this week about Matthew Perry and Friends, I think of that night often. Because you talk about if you could go back to one night, you know, or right. one day or one time, I would go back. I would go back to that evening because it was just like all was well with the world.
Right.
And right. Friends played a part in that. It just did.
Yeah, it's funny how the pop culture icons kind of do play a part in your life, even though they don't know it at all.
Yeah.
And they're really just kind of background players for you. But they, you know, they're able to spark a memory that you may not have otherwise remembered.
Yep. And
that's part of the fun of doing this show.
So it was, I'm sad. I've got nothing encouraging to say. It's just a sad moment. And I'm sorry that he passed away.
And I'm sorry that we brought the audience down.
I know. Okay, so what is today's episode
so about? Totally the opposite of death.
Doom and gloom.
Is excitement about television game shows.
So when we started dating, that was one of the early on quirks that I realized about you. You were a huge, like, 70s, 80s game show geek.
Yes, I was.
And you could sit around, if it was possible, and watch those game shows all day, every day.
No, not all day, every day.
Yeah, you could.
But there was definitely, you know, a period of, if I was bored, there's nothing going on, maybe it's a rainy day outside, and we're sitting inside, yeah, and there's nothing good on TV. Let's switch over to the game show channel and watch Gene Rayburn, this tiny little skinny long microphone, do some match game.
So we're going to talk about 80s game shows today, but I do want to preface this episode by saying this is not the only game show episode we will ever do. So we have had a conversation. There are certain game shows we are not going to talk about today because we feel they deserve probably more attention than just a quick mention in an episode with multiple game shows.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, do you have any in mind that...
Double Dare.
Yeah, Double Dare definitely should have, if not its own episode, it should be the main course of an episode. Because that was... All the TV game shows in the 80s were all adults, right? And that seems to me like it was the first true kids TV game show, unless you want to get local. And our local station had a game show on Saturday mornings called DB's Delight, and it was where kids from like local middle schools would compete against each other in almost like a Jeopardy type thing, but a trivia quiz type game. But other than that, Double Dare is the first one that I can remember that was like national, kids game show. So that one is going to get its own episode, so we won't be talking much more about Double Dare and Mark Summers today.
Yeah, don't add us. We know Double Dare's coming.
You can still add us. You can still add us. We still love talking about it. Double Dare is coming.
Price is Right?
Price is Right will come also.
I'm going to say something a little controversial here. I think Price is Right deserves its own episode more than Double Dare.
Probably. It was on the air forever. Bob Barker is famous for not only hosting the show for 30 plus years, but also beating up Happy Gilmore at the Pro-Am golf tournament.
So we won't talk about those today, but we will in future episodes.
So you've already outed me as a game show nerd. Did you watch game shows back in the 80s?
So a little bit. You know, of course, I spent all my time at Papaw and Nanny's. You mm-hmm. know this. Price is Right was on every day at 11 o'clock.
Every day at 11 o'clock in my house, too.
I feel like the world could be ending around them, and it would be like, oh, 11 o'clock, Price is Right time.
Yeah, you know, stop like, what you're doing.
Yeah, you're flipping on the TV, and then so you watched Price is Right into the 12 o'clock news. And that was just a time when everything stopped.
That's right.
So I don't know if I wanted to watch Price is Right or if it's just one of those things, like it just became something that we did. And so I just went along with it.
It was a staple.
Yeah, because you didn't, you know, back in the 80s, you didn't say, oh, but I don't want to watch that. No. My papaw had gone and fought for his country in Germany and almost died. The man, right. Price is Right brought this man happiness. We were watching it, and it was the only TV in the house.
Absolutely.
So shut up and watch it.
Exactly. And that's my feelings about it, too.
So of course, we watched that. I remember, which I get to talk a little bit more about Wheel of Fortune.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Wheel of Fortune, and I enjoyed watching that. It was pretty simple to follow. So mm-hmm. as a little kid, it was easy for me to keep up with.
Correct.
I enjoyed that, and I enjoyed the shopping that they did on Wheel of Fortune back in the 80s. But
are you going to talk about that later?
We will talk about that later. Okay. And I remember Win, Lose, or Draw.
Ah, Pictionary on TV.
Because that's when you got to see celebrities kind of being like normal people.
Themselves.
Yeah.
You could see their personality a little bit.
They'd get competitive, or they were just clueless. Or, you know, you got to see like a little insight into who they were.
Yes.
And I thought as a little kid, that was pretty fun.
Yeah, I enjoyed those as well. You mentioned The Price is Right. That was a staple on forever. And then we've got a couple of game shows that we're going to talk about. You mentioned Win, Lose, or Draw
yeah.
and Wheel of Fortune. So a couple of my favorites were the $25,000 Pyramid and Press Your Luck.
Okay.
So, you know, I love the game shows because, again, like you said, they were on. It was a staple. But I also always have had this idea, even as a little kid, of how can I beat the game?
Yes.
How can I be that's better than the game?
Describes you to a T.
What can I figure out to win the game? What can I figure out that somebody else doesn't know to win the game? And so that's why I enjoyed the game shows. I always thought, you know, these people are adults, and not all of them. Some of them were very, very good. But they didn't pick people out in game shows for their intelligence. They picked them out for their exuberance or, you know, maybe their smile or their personality or just for them being over the top. Sometimes that goes hand in hand with intelligence, and sometimes that goes hand in hand with, well, less than intelligence.
So I think I could have a chance of making it on Wheel of Fortune. I believe you would have a chance at Jeopardy. See, I think Jeopardy, they do look for intelligence. I know I'm getting off topic. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no. Keep going. No, that's fine. Jeopardy, I don't think Jeopardy does not look for personality.
Jeopardy is the next step up from just the everyday man's game show.
Yes, they look for intelligence, and I am not intelligent enough to be on Jeopardy.
Oh, please. Okay.
I do believe that I could have dominated Who Wants to Be a Millionaire because that's multiple guests. But Jeopardy, you know, I'm okay. I'm fine. Single Jeopardy, it gets into Double Jeopardy, and I start getting in trouble. Unless they're just going to do all sports or 1980s television game shows.
Well, yeah. Then it's your game.
Okay. So, we've mentioned our four game shows. Do you want to go first or do you want me to go first?
I'll go first.
All right. You go first, pick your game show and talk about it.
Okay. I'm going to start with Win, Lose, or Draw.
Okay.
You good with that?
Absolutely.
Okay. It aired from 1987 to 1990. It was in syndication and on NBC. It was co-produced by Burt and Burt Productions. So I didn't realize this, but that was headed by Burt Reynolds and Burt Convy.
Burt Convy, one of the great game show hosts of all time. Many game shows did he host.
He was the original host of the syndicated version of Win, Lose, or Draw. I probably know Burt Convy, but maybe just not by his name. What did he host?
Burt Convy hosted, obviously, Win, Lose, or Draw. He hosted Password Plus and Super Password. And he may have hosted, like, Card Sharks or something like that.
Okay.
I'm going to have to look him up now because you got me wondering what else he has done, but I'll show you a picture of him right there. You're clearly going to recognize that guy.
I mean, that hair. Who could forget that hair? That head of hair.
Oh, he was born in St. Louis.
No way.
Yeah, maybe that's why I liked him so much. I didn't know that, but...
So, you had kind of mentioned this a second ago, but New York Magazine described Win, Lose, or Draw as a knockoff of the board game Pictionary.
Yes, that's totally 100% what it was.
The set for the original Win, Lose, or Draw was modeled after Burt Reynolds' living room. That fascinated me.
Wow, I did not know.
How cool is that?
That I did not know. By the way, Burt Convy, I said Password Plus, it was actually Super Password, Win, Lose, or Draw. And Tattletales was the third.
Tattletales?
Yeah, Tattletales. You remember Tattletales at all?
No. It sounds like a lounge or something.
It kind of does.
I think, though, even though my notes say that the set was modeled after Burt Reynolds' living room, it was really Lonnie Anderson's living room. Wouldn't you say? Do you think Big Burt really cared what his living room looked like?
I don't know. But Burt Reynolds was a man's man.
He was.
So he may have, like, put his foot down and said, I want it to be like this, or he may have just been like, you know what, I don't care, you take care of it.
So the pilot was hosted by Burt Convy, which I had just mentioned that. It was taped November 2nd of 1986. Listen to the celebrity guests.
Yes.
Lonnie Anderson.
Of course.
Tony Danza.
Angela.
Betty White.
Of course.
Burt Reynolds. And they had Rod Roddy announcing.
Rod Roddy from The Price is Right. Come on down.
So, I mean, no wonder it was picked up. How could you not pick it up after that pilot?
Well, especially with those celebrities, right?
Yeah. Vicki Lawrence was the one who went on and hosted the syndicated version of Win, Lose, or Draw, except for 1 month in 1988 when Sally Struthers hosted in her place. That's who I remember, Vicki Lawrence, who I loved anyways from Mama's Family. The syndicated version of Win, Lose, or Draw faced off against the second half of Price is Right each day.
Oh.
So I'm thinking I probably didn't see it in syndication. I probably saw it when it was on doing its nightly thing.
Yeah, you're kind of in trouble if you're going against the Price is Right.
I mean, that's going to be really hard to overcome.
I don't think the Game Show Network was probably hundreds of millions of people. I think it was probably pretty isolated. And I would say that Price is Right probably got most of that share, wouldn't you?
Yes. Okay, so here's how the game worked. There were two teams. Men faced off against women, which I don't remember that specifically. Each composed of two celebrities and one everyday contestant.
Okay.
They took turns guessing a phrase, title, or thing while one teammate was drawing on a large pad of paper with markers in front of the group. Each team sat on a couch. The show was known for the celebrities specifically getting excited and getting into guessing, and they never stayed on the couch.
Right.
Which then sometimes led to it being difficult to see what the person, for the TV audience, to see what the person was drawing.
Right, right.
Because they would kind of gather around the person that was drawing, and us at home, we were like, well, I can't see it anymore. I have no idea what's going on.
All I see is the back of Bert's head.
Exactly. The team member doing the drawing could not speak about the subject in his or her drawing and could not use letters, numbers, or symbols. If one of these illegal clues was used, any money won in that puzzle was split between the two teams. However, if a non-drawing team member mentioned a word that was part of the answer, Their teammate at the sketch pad was then allowed to write it down on the pad.
Oh, nice. Nice.
So there was not big money given away on this game show. You ready? In the first three rounds, each team had 1 minute to solve a puzzle, earning $200 for a correct guess. At the 30-second mark, a doorbell sounded, and the drawing player had the option of handing the marker off to one of his or her teammates. But the puzzle value would then be cut in half. So then we're going from $200 to $100.
And I'm assuming that you've only got one guesser too, right? Because yeah, there's three people right. to a team.
If the team did not guess within the time limit, the opposing team was given one chance to get together, talk about it, and make a guess. If they gave the correct answer, they were awarded the money. If not, no money was awarded. Following round three, one player for each team was nominated to draw clues in a 90-second speed round.
Speed round. I remember
this was the fun part.
Yes.
The topics for drawing were simpler for this round compared to those in the previous rounds, and each correct guess was worth $100. The team could only pass twice. So if you couldn't figure out what they were drawing, you could pass, but you could only do that twice.
Okay.
The speed round started with the team that was ahead. The team with the most money at the end of the game won, and the contestant on the winning team received $1,000 in addition to the money they had already earned. If both teams were tied at the end of the speed round, each contestant earned $500. By the end of the daytime version's run, the speed round was decreased to 60 seconds and $50 a word.
So I feel like these people had to probably fly out on their own dime, stay in a hotel. Maybe it was paid for by production, maybe it wasn't. But I feel like anything they won was spent trying to get there.
Yeah, it's like you're not really getting anything from this.
Yeah, so win, lose, or draw, the fact that I can't draw anyway, I like the guessing part, but the fact that I can't draw, and then the fact that the best I'm probably going to do is break even, I'm not wasting my time with win, lose, or draw.
So I think, well, that's probably why it didn't last that long, but was the appeal to be on that show to have the feeling that you were friends with these celebrities.
Yes. And maybe, just maybe, Burt Reynolds takes you on a ride in that black Trans Am.
Right. But I think maybe that feeling of sitting on the couch, you know, you're whispering, you're acting like your buddies. Was that the appeal to being on the show? Because you ain't getting no money.
No, yeah, that probably is the appeal, right? Like, everybody wants to rub elbows with celebrities. Yeah. You know, if you see one out at dinner or whatever, you know, you're kind of pointing and whispering. And if you're really rude, you go up and ask them for an autograph.
So I wanted to find online a list of celebrities that appeared on Win, Lose, or Draw.
Did you find it?
I could not find it. And I was like going crazy trying to find it. I did find a short list. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to read it to you. You tell me if you recognize these names or not.
Okay.
Linda Blair.
Okay. The Exorcist.
Zelda Rubinstein.
I recognize the last name Rubinstein, but the only Zelda I think of is Zelda from Pet Sematary.
For the game Zelda.
Oh, obviously, yes. How can an 80s kid forget The Legend of Zelda?
John Astin.
Oh, yes. That's Gomez Adams.
Obviously, Sally Struthers. Richard Simmons.
Of course. Richard Simmons. He should have been on every 80s game show. Oh,
you know it. Marcia Wallace.
Don't recognize that
name. I believe she was the secretary in the Bob Newhart show.
Okay, okay.
I think. Burt Reynolds, Richard Klein.
No, I don't recognize that name.
Barbara Eden.
Of course.
Linda Carter.
Wonder Woman.
I'm going to butcher this name. I've been repeating it in my head like over and over because I don't want to stumble over it. Okay,
like here we go. Like in the Mary Lee Tyler Moore show.
Ricardo Montalban. Montalban.
Look, boss, the plane.
Is that who that is?
Well, no, that's Ricardo Montalban is
the bigger guy, not the little guy.
Correct.
Jason Bateman.
Yes.
How young was Jason Bateman?
He was a teenager.
And Lonnie Anderson, obviously. It was her living room.
Yeah, where was she going?
Exactly.
WKRP was over by then.
I
know.
I mean, this was it for her. So there you go.
So I recognize most of those names. I believe that Richard Simmons was probably the funniest person that was ever on that show.
Oh, no doubt.
And probably got the most laughs by far.
No doubt.
And there were comedians on there, and Richard Simmons was funnier.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. So is that your wrap up of win, lose, or draw? Yep. Any, you know, no big winners or anything like that, right?
I mean, nobody's walking home with big money here.
Okay. Well, my first game show, you could walk away with big money.
Really? Which one?
My game show is the $25,000 pyramid. So, for those of you that don't know, there were many different generations of this game. It started with the $10,000 pyramid in 1973. The $25,000 pyramid ran from 82 to 88 on CBS. And then the $100,000 pyramid ran from 85 to 88 on the CBS. And I was trying to figure out why they ran at the same time. But what I think was the $100,000 pyramid may have been like a, almost like a tournament of the $25,000 pyramid winners. But Dick Clark was the host. Now, who doesn't love Dick Clark?
I mean, yeah, that's a great host.
So there were, you know, many other hosts. There have been many other hosts for the $25,000 pyramid since then, but Dick Clark was the original. Definitely my favorite, probably my favorite host of anything ever. Right? He hosted American Bandstand. You remember that? Of course, Dick Clark's Rockin' New Year's Eve. Pyramid, he was on the radio, like Dick Clark, one of the great hosts of all time.
He was just, he made it look easy.
He, in my opinion, is like an American icon.
Yes.
So here's how the game was, here's how the game worked. There are two competing teams, each sitting at their own table. Each team consists of a regular Joe and a celebrity, kind of like a win, lose, or draw. And the first half, a contestant might be paired up with somebody. It's funny that you said Betty White was the first one on there because I remember Betty White being on the $25,000 pyramid. I think she was on every game show ever.
Well, yeah, and she was married to her husband.
Alan
was,
Ladd.
Yeah, he hosted.
Yeah, he hosted Password.
Yeah.
And something else. Maybe Jeopardy?
No, but something else.
So... You know, Joe Blow might be paired up with Betty White, while Jane Blow is paired up with William Catt.
Joe and Jane Blow?
Okay. Whatever. So, in fairness to the contestants, in case one celebrity was, like, far superior to the other celebrity, after the first game, after the first round, they would switch, right? So each contestant would get to work with each celebrity to really give the contestants a fair chance to find out who the better contestant was. So the first round consisted of teams being showed six categories, and each team would alternate choosing a category, right? Once the category was chosen, Dick Clark then gives the exact meaning, because the category names were like vague names, right? So Dick Clark would give the exact meaning of the title, something like things a baker might say, or things used in a rodeo, kind of something like that. So there were seven words or phrases that they had to guess. These words were put into some kind of magic box that the celebrity could look through and see. I never understood
what?
How that worked.
Okay, I don't remember that.
So they're looking through a box, they get the word, and then they're given, you know, they're sitting across from each other like you and I are right now, right? So I look through a box, and I see the word mug, and so I'm like, you put tea in it. You use it for coffee, and then you would hopefully guess mug, and then we'd move on to the next one.
Man, the contraptions we had in the 80s.
Right? So, if the person giving the clues gives an improper clue, you would hear a cuckoo. And then that means they have to go on to the next word. They have no chance of getting that word. That word's out. So then teams alternate turns. So team one goes first category, and team two goes second. And there's, like I said, there's seven questions in each round. So the team with the most points after three rounds, which would make 21 the most points, advance to the winner's circle. In the winner's circle round, one player must describe six categories of increasing difficulty to their partner within 60 seconds by giving a short and concise list of items relating to each category in play. So it wasn't like in the first round where I said, you know, where if the question was mug and I'd be like, you put coffee in it. You can't do that in the winner's circle round.
Okay.
You have to give like a list. Or if it's like things a butcher might say, you could then speak like a butcher would speak. But other than that, you couldn't like just talk through your clues.
Okay.
You had to give a list. Otherwise, you'd get a cuckoo. So giving an illegal clue removes the category from the play again, and you'd hear another cuckoo. So here are some examples of giving illegal clues in the winner's circle. Using a keyword in the category, because the category was usually, you know, a phrase. A definition. You couldn't give a definition.
No definition.
No definition. You couldn't give a direct synonym of the word.
Okay.
You couldn't use a prepositional phrase. I'm not even sure what that is anymore, being out of English for 30 plus years. And then you couldn't list an item that didn't fit into the category. So if you list an item, boom, they'd nail you and you'd lose it. So if the team got all six right, which seemed extremely difficult to do, the non-celebrity contestant would win $10,000.
And that's a lot of money back then.
That was a lot of money back then. The celebrity, if the person did win that $10,000, the celebrity would act as if they just won the World Series. And then the contestant's family or friends would come down to the winner's circle. And then they'd get questioned by Dick Clark as if they were a perp for a murder.
What?
So I always liked it when the contestant got like the fifth answer and there was like 10 seconds left for the sixth answer. And you'd hear Dick Clark yell from the side, "Hurry!"
Oh, wow. Like, we need that pressure.
Exactly. Like, the person, you know.
Mr. Clark.
The person's trying to win, you know, life-changing money. And Dick Clark's yelling at him to hurry. So the second half of the show was just like the first half, only, like I said, with the contestants switching partners. The only difference was if the person who won the first round and went, and even if they didn't win the $10,000 in the winner's circle, the first round, if they won the second round, they went back to the winner's circle and they would play for $25,000.
Oh, wow.
So if they won $10,000 in the first round, then they won $25,000 in the second round. I don't think they got $35,000. I think they just got the $25,000.
Well, that doesn't seem fair.
Well, it doesn't seem fair, but they did get to come back and play again.
Oh, they did?
Yes. So somebody
like
could
on the next episode?
Yeah. So somebody could dominate for like a week and theoretically, you know, they probably wouldn't, but theoretically they could have pulled down $125,000 in a week.
Well, that's exciting.
Celebrities were used 1 week at a time. So the celebrities would be on mm-hmm. five shows. They probably taped them all on the same day, right?
Probably.
And so they were on 1 week at a time. And typically they were there to promote their new work, whether it be a movie, a new show on Broadway, or in Betty White's case, Golden Girls.
Yeah.
As well as her discovery of the Fountain of Youth that was sought after by so many explorers in the 1500s.
Oh. I love me some Betty.
I know. Everybody loved Betty White. And you know, I think God knew that, and that's why he let her live for 140 years. So that's really all I've got for the gameplay on $25,000 Pyramid. I enjoyed it because I like trying to, obviously I couldn't guess the clues because the clues were up there for you, but I like to think of words that, you know, or phrases that might help a contestant guess a clue. And I also like to, you know, call the person an idiot who couldn't figure out a simple clue.
Now, when was Jim doing this? Was it little Jim?
You know, I was like 9, 10 years old.
Okay.
You know, and obviously it came on in the morning. And so I really only saw it during the summer, like before I'd go out and start playing.
Okay.
Like you'd wake up late, right? You'd sit there and you'd eat your breakfast and watch $25,000 Pyramid.
Okay.
Or Press Your Luck, which I'll get into later.
Right.
If it was raining, you'd get to watch The Price is Right. Usually we were out of the house by Price is Right time.
Right.
But if it was raining, we get to watch Price is Right too.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's my story on Pyramid.
There's some real money to be had there.
Absolutely. That was the big one that I remember. Like, you win more money on that than you could on Jeopardy back then.
That's impressive. Okay. Well, I got the pleasure of preparing and researching for Wheel of Fortune.
Which was like your favorite, right?
Yes. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Wheel of Fortune before I talk about why it was my favorite.
Absolutely.
But yes, absolutely. Hands down. And I wish that we could go back and resurrect this specific version that I enjoyed so much. Okay, Wheel of Fortune was created by Merv Griffin in 1975. The game is based basically on Hangman.
Yes.
I mean, I feel like if you're listening to this podcast and you don't know the premise of Wheel of Fortune, then you should probably maybe just, like, not listen.
No, we never want to discourage people from listening. You should always listen, and you should come back here to learn about things that you may not know.
But, I mean, seriously? Is there somebody out there that does... Somebody out there our age or older that doesn't know about Wheel of Fortune?
I would doubt it, unless they grew up without a TV.
Okay. In each round, three players would compete to be the first to guess all the unknown words in a word puzzle, which was displayed or is displayed visually on the board containing 52 spaces. At the start of each round, the host reveals the category. In general, puzzles must be read exactly. A contestant must solve the puzzle in order to keep any cash, prizes, or extras accumulated during that round, except for the wild card round, which we did not have back in the 80s. I still felt I needed to mention it.
That's fine. Nope.
The contestant with the highest total winnings wins the game overall and advances to the bonus round. When the current bonus round was introduced in 1981, no letters were provided automatically. The contestant asked for five consonants and a vowel and then had 15 seconds to attempt solving the puzzle. Also, bonus prizes were selected by the contestant at the start of that round.
Oh, why? Do you have any examples of those prizes?
I do not.
All right.
And I knew you were going to ask.
And you just wanted to smite me?
I found myself getting in the weeds of the ins and outs of this game, and it made my head hurt.
You could probably spend like half a day reading about
right, it, like right? The ins and the outs, and we did this, and then we did that, and now we do this, and then we're going to do that. And I was just like, holy goodness. And this is a show that I've watched my whole life, and my head was like spinning.
I will say that given the contestants five consonants and one vowel to guess in 15 seconds, it seemed like the puzzles were easier to guess back then than they are now when they automatically give them the five and the one and
correct.
Then give three more and a vowel.
Well, they got to up the ante kind of thing. I mean, because then people are just going to be taking stuff left and right.
Yeah, I get that. But man, it is hard now.
Okay, so now we're getting into what I loved about the show in the 1980s.
Okay.
Originally, after winning a round, contestants spent their winnings on prize showcases that were presented on stage. They had sections of the set up as different rooms to look like different rooms in a home. It was on like a spinning circle.
Oh, is that what it was? I always felt like they had like a little drone going through.
Well, no,
and I know we hadn't invented drones yet, but I felt like they had a little drone going through.
At any time during a shopping round, a contestant could choose to put his or her winnings either on a gift certificate or on account for use in a later shopping round.
Ooh.
I don't remember that.
I don't either. But what if you didn't win another round?
Okay.
Yeah.
Money put on account was lost if the contestant hit bankrupt or failed to solve another puzzle.
Then you'd be a fool to not grab that fancy white sofa.
So I watched a couple of episodes on YouTube when preparing for this episode, and it felt like to me that Pat Sajak, and that I've not even spoken about him yet, but I've got a little blurb on him, he really pushed the contestants to put the money on a gift certificate.
Oh, did he?
He did.
Do you think he got like 10% or something?
I don't know, but he really pushed them because, you know, people get up there and like there's a lot to see. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to take in. And, you know, their mind, they're trying to, like, focus on the items. And he's over there like, let's go.
Yeah.
And he's keeping a tally. I don't know how he kept the tally as quickly as he did. And then it would get down to, like, $200. And you know there was something up there that was $200. And he was like, and he was just like, he was pushing him, go fast, go fast, go fast, go fast. And then he was like, you've got $217.25. Do you want that to go on a gift certificate? And of course, the person's little head's just spinning. Right. So they were like, yeah, sure. And then bam, on to the next round.
So one of two things here. Pat was getting a kickback from the certificates.
I know.
Or he was just trying to keep it moving like a good host would.
He was.
Right?
He was
because totally. Otherwise you're going to have, that's like putting a kid in a candy store and going, okay, pick out like three items. They're going to take a half an hour looking through all their options before they pick their best.
I actually read that he hated this part of the show.
Is that why they switched it?
I'm sure it had something to do with it. But also, contestants were then responsible to pay the taxes on the items they got.
Well, then they should have definitely kept those gift certificates for IRS. For
the tax. So
it should have been IRS gift certificates.
Wheel of Fortune, you have to pay your way out there. Okay. Right. They do not put you up. They don't pay for your airfare. They're not paying for your food. You got to cover that. And then whatever you're buying, you got to then pay the tax on that. So the average Joe is, I'm not sure it's feasible for the average Joe.
Lose-lose. It's a lose-lose situation.
So contestants went shopping on the show for years until the segment was finally cut in 1989.
Yeah, and think about it, because, like, you know, you're watching a game show, you're into the game show, you're trying to guess the puzzles, and then you just get a time killer of these people trying to decide, dining room set they want, or if they want a tchotchke for their end table in their bedroom.
So, you know what, and I wonder, maybe they did this, but maybe if they could show the set before the game and tell them, like, here's the set, take a look at it. Kind of have an idea of what you might want.
And give them a cheat sheet of what each thing costs too. So while they're going through, they're like, oh, I just won $2,500. So I can get this thing for $1,500 and I can get this other thing for $1,000. And then I don't have to listen to Pat try and force his gift certificate on me that he's getting a kickback for.
You know it. So prizes could be anything from patio furniture to exercise suits.
Oh, the mafia. Didn't any mafia people go on there?
Think about, the ladies and men's, matching exercise suits.
I feel like maybe my parents snuck their way on Wheel of Fortune and got those for my Meemaw when she got older.
To stationary bikes, to luggage, to crystal, to wallpaper, to ceramic Dalmatian statues.
Wait a minute. Go back. You said crystal? Like the hamburger place? Crystal?
Not the hamburger place and not Crystal Gale, like crystal that you like a crystal vase or a crystal bowl or
not crystal.
No.
Okay.
That ceramic Dalmatian dog, he became the mascot of Wheel of Fortune. They named him Sheldon. And the price of the ceramic dog was originally set at $154.
Did anybody ever get it?
Yes, all the time. That was like one of the more popular items.
Why would you want a ceramic dog? That's weird.
Like, you know, that
it's life size, right? Life size,
yeah.
That's just strange.
That was the 80s. Okay.
Unless you were living in a fire department, why would you want a ceramic Dalmatian dog?
That's so funny. So I shouldn't come home with one? Is that what you're saying?
No. I mean, unless you go win big on Wheel of Fortune.
Okay. So the version of Wheel of Fortune that we're used to now with Pat Sajak and Vanna White debuted September 19th, 1983.
40 years they've been on it.
The original version, and I think I remember this, it was a network daytime series that ran on NBC, then flipped to CBS, before then returning to NBC in 1991, and then it was canceled that year. So that was the syndicated daytime version, but I feel like that threw my nanny off big time.
That's funny. I do not remember that at all. I only know the Pat and Vanna version.
Okay. So the network version was originally hosted by Chuck Woolery.
Another guy who's hosted thousands of game shows.
He left in 1981 and he was replaced by Pat Sajak. So Pat Sajak, do you remember this? He left the show briefly in 1989 to host his own late night talk show?
Yes, I do. I don't know. Did somebody fill in for him or did he just like take a break?
Okay. Well, he took a break. They got a replacement. He never left the nighttime version. This was the syndicated daytime version. Oh,
okay. Okay. No, I didn't. I didn't realize. I guess I didn't realize he did the syndicated daytime version.
The daytime version had a couple of different hosts during that time, but their names didn't ring a bell with me, so I didn't write them down. So okay. I'm sorry.
But yeah, I do remember Pat Sajak trying to get himself a talk show
for a hot minute. And I think he's like super conservative.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I think so. Okay, so Pat and Vanna have racked up some pretty impressive accolades throughout the years, including they each have a spot in the Guinness Book of World Records. Don't you think that the Guinness Book of World Records was a much bigger deal in the 80s than it is now?
It was huge. Like, it was, like, that's what you went to. That was your go-to book if you were trying to figure something out, or if you wanted to become, like, semi-famous, even though you're not really famous. So,
if I met you in the 80s, and if you had have said, or let's say I met you and your twin brother, and you had have said, I won a Nobel Peace Prize, and your twin brother said, I'm in the Guinness Book of World Records, I would instantly date your twin brother. Because that would have been more impressive to me in the 80s.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. Who cared about the Nobel Peace Prize in the 80s?
Yeah, right.
I mean, I'm sure the adults did, but we didn't as kids. I could care less. Like, my life was peaceful. Or my life wasn't peaceful. I was getting into fights every day. Didn't matter. I didn't care if you were winning the Nobel Peace Prize, if you had a peace pipe, all that stuff. But I definitely wanted to know who the tallest man who ever lived was, Robert Wadlow from Alton, Illinois at 9'4".
We've been there. Okay, so Pat's title is for the longest career as a game show host of the same show. When he was given that title in 2019, his career had spanned 35 years.
Yeah, I mean, if you said it debuted on September 29th, 1983, well, we're past September 29th.
Yeah.
So he has been doing it for 40 years now.
He is retiring next year.
Yes.
Okay, Vanna landed in the Guinness Book of World Records for clapping.
For clapping?
She was given the title of television's most frequent clapper.
That's not a world record.
When she was honored in 2014, they said she had averaged more than 600 claps per show, totaling 3.7 million claps.
Okay, so if they can quantify it, then yes, I will agree that it's a world record. But I just thought they were just like, oh, she claps the most, she gets a world record.
So, and I don't think this is how Vanna White is, but that almost comes across as like, wait, but he gets one, I want one. Like, come on. Couldn't we have come up with something else?
Yeah, I don't think she's like that either. But, I mean, who knows? She hardly ever speaks.
Oh, well, yeah, they don't let her. Okay, so I've got just a couple of fun facts.
I'm surprised they let her out of the kitchen in the 80s.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I'm going to run through some fun facts quickly. The wheel tips the scale at 2,400 pounds.
Wow.
Vanna never wears the same outfit twice, which is how she's managed to wear more than 6,500 evening gowns on the show.
See, and that's what I thought she was going to be in the Guinness Book of World Records for.
Wheel of Fortune is one of the quickest produced game shows on television, shooting almost 1 month's worth of episodes in just the matter of a few days.
Wow.
Wheel of Fortune ranks as the longest running syndicated game show in the U.S., with over 7,000 episodes taped and aired. I'd like to buy a vowel is the most commonly used phrase on the show, but did you know that the vowel has never been adjusted for inflation? It still cost $250, the same price it's been since the primetime version of the show first aired in 1983.
So people are making a lot more money now than they were back then.
Over 1 million people request to audition each year. From that, more than 10,000 hopefuls get to try out, and roughly 600 people become contestants.
You know why so many people audition?
Because it's like the everyman show.
Because everybody in their life has played hangman.
Right. Yeah. And it's, you don't have to be necessarily smart. You can be almost any age, any economic background, anywhere in the country.
And I don't think you have to be smart to figure out puzzles like that either, right? Like, you can go on there and be an average of average intelligence and just kick even the smart people's butt because of, one, the way the game is played, but two, you just might be good at figuring out phrases or solving puzzles, right, or whatever. So, right, I think that does go into the everyman's play.
But nothing would make me more excited than if they would bring back the shopping experience. I'm telling you, if Pat tried to rush me,
You say, I got a gift certificate for you, Pat Sajak.
Exactly. Give me a minute. I want to pick. Do I want the sofa or do I want the library table? Give me a minute. I don't know. And you know they way overpriced that stuff.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's inflated.
Like in one of the episodes I watched, this young college guy picked a set of luggage and it was like $550.
Yeah, back in the 80s. I bet back that thing was worth like $3,750 at Sears.
You know it was.
$500. I can get luggage for less than $500 nowadays. That can get me all fired up about the price of inflation. Sorry about that. So is that your...
That's what I got.
All right. I am going to talk about Press Your Luck.
I don't remember this one.
You don't at all, really?
Mm-mm. Maybe if I saw it, it might come back to me, but...
So, it aired from 1983 to 1986 on CBS. It was hosted by Peter Tamarkin, and he is mostly known for this role. Wasn't like Burt Convy or Dick Clark or... who else did you mention? Chuck Woolery, that did like thousands of game shows. Peter Tamarkin pretty much did this. It was announced by Rod Roddy.
No way.
You brought up before.
I love Rod Roddy.
He's done a lot of stuff. Is, you know, we mentioned The Price is Right and Win, Lose, or Draw, right? Yep. So the game was different than a lot of other games. There were three contestants per show. And there was four rounds in each show, each split into a half, kind of like a basketball game. There were two question rounds and two big board rounds. You're wondering what the big board round is. All right, well, we'll get to it. So the first half of the show was the two rounds, like I said. The first round was a question round consisting of four questions, and the questions were multiple choice. So Peter Tamarkin would read the question, and you could buzz in before he got to the multiple choice answers with your guess. And after the contestant buzzed in with the answer, Peter would take that answer and then put in two more multiple choice answers for the other contestants to choose from. So if the person who buzzed in got the answer right, they earned 3 points, which were translated into spins for the next portion of the show. If any of the other contestants got the multiple choice answer right, they would get a point or a spin for the next round. An incorrect answer didn't get you anything. So after the four questions, they would then go to the big board portion of the show in the first round. So each contestant got to participate in the big board as long as they had spins. The person who earned the least amount of spins would go first until they were out of spins. So here's what the big board was. It consisted of 18 spaces in a square and rectangle pattern, and with the giant words, "Press Your Luck" in the middle.
Okay.
Okay. Each space had a prize that might consist of items like a trip, cash, a Sea-Doo, you know, some of them had cash with like an extra spin, so you could increase your amount of spins that you had.
This is coming back to me.
Okay, good, good. So these spaces... each space would randomly flash, right? There might be like three or four different things on each space. But not only that, there was a random flashing light around the outline of each space. So it wouldn't just go in order. It might jump from this side, to the top, to the bottom, back to this side, to the top, still on the top, whatever. And so the player who was at turn, who had the spin, would push a red button on their podium to stop the light. And whatever the light stopped on, that's the prize that they would win. For some reason, the players, whenever they pushed the red button to stop it, they would always yell stop too.
Was that necessary?
It was not necessary. And as a kid, I was confused as to whether the yelling of stop or the pressing of button yeah. actually stopped the light, right?
Oh.
And so with the randomness of each square changing prizes and the randomness of the flashing light dancing around to any square at any time, a contestant was basically at the mercy of the algorithm that controlled each square and controlled the board. Sounds simple, right?
I mean, so far I'm tracking.
Well, a square might also have a cartoon character called a whammy.
I remember this, yes.
And if you landed on a whammy, you went bankrupt. And then he or she, the whammy, being male or female, removed all of your money. You would still get to spin and try to earn more money if you had any spins left.
Was the whammy male or female?
Could be either one.
Oh, sometimes it was a boy and sometimes it
correct.
Was. I thought it was always the boy.
Mm-mm.
I equate the whammy to the Noid.
Yes. Yes. Very similar. Very good. I like that. So there's one other whammy rule. Much like basketball having a limit of fouls per game, in Press Your Luck, you had a limit of four whammies in a game. If you get your fourth whammy, he takes all of your money and you're out of the game. Even if you had spins, your spins disappear and you lose, you are out. So you could be rolling along, picking up a wind sail, a trip to Paris, and maybe around $5,000 in cash. And then all of a sudden you hit the whammy, who may come out like he was animated. So he might come out dancing like Michael Jackson or something, right? And he takes all your money. Then you would have to start all over with the, you know, with less spins, obviously. So control of the big board in the first half always started with the person who had earned the least amount of spins the previous round. After a player stops the board, if they don't get a whammy, the cash equivalent of the prize is added to their score. If they have any remaining spins, they then have the option to either pass their remaining spins to another player with the highest score or spin again, which was known as pressing their luck.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So this round would end when all players had used all of the allotted spins, whether passed or earned, and that concluded the first half of the show. Then they'd come back, and the second half was basically a repeat of the first half, with the question portion, again, being four questions, and the spins being earned in the same fashion, right? But the big board in the second half had bigger prizes, more added spins to build, you know, the intensity in the gameplay and everything like that. And I'm pretty sure it also had more whammies in the second round, too. So to begin the second big board, the contestant, it wasn't with the lowest spins anymore. Now it was with the lowest score, the lowest amount of money in their bank. They would go first, and it would pretty much proceed just like the first half. I always felt like in the second half, that's when more strategy would come in with the passing of spins in hopes that your opponent would get a whammy and lose his money, declaring you the winner, right? So this show, most of the other shows that we talked about were really kind of based on skill, right?
Mm-hmm.
This show, for the most part, was based on luck. I mean, you did have some skill. There was some game theory in it, but for the most part, you were at kind of the mercy of the algorithm. So when the show got down to only one person having just one spin left, the producers would go to like a split screen showing the contestant that was winning and the contestant in second place. Now, the contestant who is winning could be spinning, or the contestant who's in second place could be spinning. But even with one spin left, each person had a chance to win because of the whammy, right? So if you're in second and you're trying to catch this guy, you could, you know, get money, jump over him, and you win. But if you're in second and you're not spinning, and the guy who's spinning first, you know, if he gets something, if he gets money, then obviously he wins. But if he hits a whammy, he loses and you win. So you'd get to see, in this split screen, you'd get to see both the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat in one shot. That was kind of a cool concept that they didn't really show in other game shows. I can promise you this, that 100% of the time, the show came down to a split screen of a woman with big giant hair and tons of makeup and a blue dress with shoulder pads underneath against a dude with a mustache and a $75 Woolworth suit.
I didn't know what on her was going to be big when you started talking.
Big hair.
Oh.
So I guess the cool thing about this game that was maybe a little bit different than some of the other games was even the losers, as Tom Petty would say, they would take home their prizes and our cash if they hadn't ended the game on a whammy and
really?
Gone bankrupt.
Yeah. So if I got that Ski-Doo, I could take it home.
Absolutely.
Wow.
The winner would get to come back and play again. I always thought as a kid that I could dominate the game because that's what I always did as a kid, right? But, you know, a lot of it was luck. But usually players would win with anywhere from maybe $6,000 to $15,000. I remember, you know, a lot of times players winning around $10,000. That seemed like a lot of money back then. Well, there was a dude named Michael Larson who went on the show in 1984, about a year or so after it started. And he did what I would have done if I was an adult working with my 10-year-old mind. He recorded episodes at home with his VCR and played them back frame by frame.
Oh, my word.
By doing this, he found out that the randomness of the spaces changing and the light dancing was not random at all. He memorized the pattern.
No way.
And then he went on the show.
Oh, my.
He got a whammy on his first spin. And then he went 45 consecutive spins without hitting another one. I've never seen anyone go like maybe more than 10 spins. Whoa. And if they got up to like 7, 8, 9, I'm screaming at the pass, man, you're so lucky, pass. And, you know, the odds are against you. Question, how did he get to 45 spins?
Yeah, how did he?
Right? Because each of the highest valued spaces have money with extra spins on them. So there's a space on the board called Big Bucks, and whenever you landed on that, it would jump to whatever the highest dollar amount was, and that always included an extra spin. So this dude's just nailing Big Bucks after Big Bucks, or he's nailing like the high ones or the corner ones or whatever. Like, he got it.
Were they on to him?
So, yes, eventually. So, his turn lasted so long that CBS ran the episode in two parts. He ended up winning $110,000 in cash and prizes. There was an investigation by CBS executives.
Yeah, I bet.
Because their rule was, even if you came back, the most you could win was $25,000.
Oh.
Once you got to $25,000 or over $25,000, you weren't allowed back on the show again. So they determined that he did not cheat and that he could keep the prize money. But then they went back and changed their board to include 32 new patterns that would keep someone from learning them again.
Oh, wow. So they figured out what he was doing?
Yeah. I think they probably questioned him, and he probably told them. You know, he's like, I figured out your algorithm, right? I figured out your pattern. Man. I didn't cheat. I wasn't using, you know, anything while I was playing. But I just took you for $110,000. And, you know, $110,000 back then is really probably close to $500,000
That's
now.
Big money.
No, it's big bucks.
It's big bucks.
And no whammies.
So was this game show on during the day?
It was. So it came on earlier than The Price is Right, and I think earlier than the $25,000 pyramid.
Okay.
So, and I think it came on a different station. So my game plan during the summer was wake up at, I think this show maybe came on at 9 or something. So wake up at 8:45. you know, not on purpose. That's just what time I woke up. Go upstairs, fix my bowl of Fruit Loops or Cocoa Puffs or Sugar Smacks or whatever. Sit on the couch in my little tidy whities. Eat my cereal and watch Press Your Luck and yell at dumb people. People with big hair. People with $75 Woolworth suits.
Oh.
Then I would watch $25,000 Pyramid because who can resist Dick Clark?
Right.
And then after that, either Price is Right was on or they had like an hour long. But either way, by that time I was out the door. And it was bike riding, wiffle ball playing, whatever with friends.
Right.
You know, making up stuff.
Right. getting into fights.
If necessary.
Oh.
So that was Press Your Luck. I probably, if you've never seen it, I'm not sure how me describing the game, whether it was helpful or just made things more confusing, or if I did even a decent job of describing it all.
I think you did a good job describing it. I felt like I did a lousy job describing Wheel of Fortune. So
everybody knows what Wheel of Fortune is.
Exactly. So if I can't sum it up and describe it for somebody, then I don't know if I...
I don't know that you necessarily talked about spinning the wheel on Wheel of Fortune. We just kind of talked about solving the clues.
Yeah, we did.
But, I mean, yeah, you spun the wheel.
Everybody gets a practice spin because the wheel is much heavier...
than what they think
than,
it was.
Than what you would
did
think.
Did you ever notice that there were, like, some dudes... Like, I felt like there were some stronger guys that could spin it and make it go all the way around, or just short of all the way around, like one or two spaces of all the way around. Then how did those dudes ever, ever, ever hit lose a turn or bankrupt? Like, I felt like if you were consistent going around and you could see that you were one short or two short every single time, you could see before you spun that if you were going to be too short, you were going to hit a bankrupt or lose your turn. So spin it a little bit softer. So
I'm actually glad you brought this up. I always thought it was rigged.
How?
I don't know. I'm not that smart.
Like maybe they made the wheel heavier when they needed to?
Well, somehow they could control the spin.
No, it's not a carnival Wheel of Fortune.
I mean, how do you know? Because... haven't you ever watched and you're like rooting this person on and they're like doing really well and then suddenly it's wah, 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 and they land on bankrupt and it never comes back around to them again. So they're just like out of luck.
Yeah. I'm trying to think if I ever rooted for anybody or if I just thought that I could beat them all.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the difference between... Jim and myself.
That is true.
Well, this was fun.
It was. It was. And we're going to do our own game show episode next.
Is it going to be a mini-sode?
We'll see. It may be a mini-sode. It may be a non-Minnesode.
No, we're not in Minnesota.
No, we're not in Minnesota. That's our friends.
And we're also working on a couple of Thanksgiving episodes. I'm excited about
that. We are. Maybe one, maybe two. We don't know
yet. Two. I think it's got to be two.
You think so?
I think so.
Okay.
So, but anyways, thanks for bearing with us as we're trying to survive this, what, changing weather, maybe? I don't know what
changing weather and just little kids passing around. Sickness as if they were little tiny petri dishes. But this was fun. We were due another TV episode, so we got a TV episode out there now.
Yep. And we will do another episode, and we'll cover Double Dare.
Yeah, that'll be further on down the road. Don't hold your breath for that one.
Maybe even Family Feud.
Oh, yeah, Family Feud's definitely on the list. Right. We got to talk about how Richard Dawson kissed every woman.
Yep.
What a perv.
And they let him.
Yeah, they were pervs too.
Ew. Okay, well.
Anyways. We may also, since you just mentioned Family Feud, and you mentioned Vicki Lawrence hosting Win, Lose, or Draw, we may have to talk about the episode of Mama's Family.
I love
when they went on Family Feud.
I love a good crossover.
Yes.
Can that be called a crossover?
Maybe.
I think let's do it.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. Well, we just want to thank our listeners again. We want to thank our listeners overseas.
Oh, yeah. We've got people listening across the pond.
Absolutely. We love that. You may not have been into the game shows or the TV shows that we watched over here, but hopefully, you enjoy that. And we know music is universal. And maybe you're not even a native. Maybe you're just a U.S. citizen that's over there listening.
Right. I don't know. So maybe it makes total sense. So maybe
everything makes sense. But either way, we appreciate you tuning in and listening. And we would appreciate it if you would review us and rate us.
Yeah, we need some good reviews.
And tell a friend. Telephone. Telegraph.
Tell a friend via phone.
Text a friend.
Don't fax a friend.
Faxes, no, that's totally 80s.
Totally. And 90s. Okay. You can find us on social media. We're Jim Does X. I do Instagram. I do Facebook.
At Children of _ 80s.
And until next time, I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Jim.
And we are Children of the 80s.